Attention listeners, AfterSight's annual hike is coming up on July 27th.
It was a really good experience for me.
Visit aftersight.org/hike and become an audio trekker today.
That hike today gave me so much courage.
Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the Boulder Daily News, read by Kathy Piancone. This is being recorded for Tuesday, April 23rd. Today we will be reading the following main articles. Longmont Meeting. Council to Discuss Compost, U.S. 287 Study, by Matthew Bennett. Boulder City Council. Social Street Program Gets Mixed Reviews, by Amber Carlson. Aid to Come from U.S. Ukraine Struggles at Front Lines, by Samia Kulab. And following up with miscellaneous articles. Longmont Meeting. Council to Discuss Compost, U.S. 287 Study, by Matthew Bennett. The Longmont Sustainability Advisory Board will present to the City Council Tuesday about increasing composting availability for residents and businesses. A1 Organics, the city's compost processor, announced last year that beginning April 1, 2023, it would no longer accept compostable items such as paper cups, plates, utensils, and other paper products due to excessive contamination. Now, residents can only place food scraps and yard waste in their curbside composting containers. When announcing the change, A1 Organics said that non-compostable look-alike items often ended up in its compost stream, which took time and labor to remove. Contamination significantly increased A1 Organics' operating costs, thus making composting less economically viable, the announcement said. In October, the Sustainability Advisory Board approved a resolution in support of increasing the ability of Longmont residents and businesses to compost all reasonably compostable materials. The resolution's specific language asks the City Council to explore with haste options such as partnering with A1 Organics on an educational campaign to help eliminate non-compostable plastics, glass, and other materials from entering the compost stream. The resolution also advocates for partnering with neighboring communities to ensure and support the viability of regional, large-scale, industrial composting facilities. Longmont Mayor Joan Peck made a motion directing staff to engage in the conversations Boulder County is having about a regional composting facility during the April 9th City Council meeting. The council voted unanimously in support of Peck's motion. In addition to composting availability, the City Council is expected to discuss the findings from Boulder County's U.S. 287 Vision Zero Safety and Mobility Study during its regular session Tuesday. The study, which started in 2022, was finalized in December 2023. Examined the roughly 24-mile stretch of U.S. 287 between Midway Boulevard in Broomfield and Horseshoe Circle at the Boulder-Larimer County line. The plan calls for specific measures to eliminate fatal and severe injury crashes along U.S. 287, namely a center median barrier in the rural sections of the corridor north and south of Longmont, according to a council memo. Council member Diane Crist, who previously served on the city's Transportation Advisory Board, said Monday that she has received complaints, particularly from businesses along North Main Street, U.S. 287, about traffic coming into the city at a high rate of speed. "It's an important study," to just have the facts and figure out how to slow down the traffic and how to make it safer, Christ said. In January, two men died in a head-on crash on U.S. 287 just north of Longmont. Tuesday's regular city council meeting is scheduled to begin at 7 p.m. in the city council chambers, 350 Kimbark Street. Boulder City Council. Social Streets program gets mixed reviews by Amber Carlson. Boulder staffers have been exploring ways to make the city's downtown streets livelier by turning them into social spaces where community members can enjoy spending time. The so-called Boulder Social Streets Project, formerly called Downtown Streets as Public Spaces, has aimed to reimagine downtown streets as welcoming spaces to gather, attend events, and connect, according to the project website. But at a city council meeting Thursday evening, city council members expressed ambivalence about the project. Several said they appreciate the intent behind the project and the efforts staffers have put into it, but some members shared concerns about the amount of time and money the project has consumed. The idea of repurposing Boulder's downtown streets as social spaces was partly sparked by vehicular street closures related to the COVID-19 pandemic. West Pearl Street was closed to auto traffic for a period of time and used as a space for outdoor dining, gathering, and community programming. Although West Pearl Street reopened to vehicle traffic in September 2022, there's been a strong demand for more community gathering spaces in downtown Boulder. After West Pearl was reopened, many residents asked the city to close the street to traffic again. However, community members didn't agree across the board on how or where downtown streets should be repurposed. The city has worked with outside consultants from several firms, including urban design firm Gehl, to develop recommendations for the program. To test out some different potential uses for Boulder Street, the city rolled out a pilot program last year consisting of a series of pop-up community events, according to a presentation Gehl consultants gave to council members on Thursday. 8 different events were held along 13th Street between June 24th and September 25th. It was a successful, though imperfect, season, said Helena Wolf, a designer with Gehl. Overall, there's enthusiasm and a lot of momentum for continuing to evolve the Social Streets program. The events themselves received generally positive feedback from the community, with attendees saying the events felt welcoming, safe, and created more of a pull to spend time downtown. In fact, 40% of the event goers said the best way for the Social Streets program to change Boulder streets would be to close streets to cars and convert roadways into plazas. Multiple council members, including council member Taisha Adams, praised the Melanin Funk Fest in particular and said they want to see the city hosted again. One of the goals or objectives of this project was to test programs, and so we tested them. Some of them worked, and I just don't understand why we wouldn't continue those that were hugely successful, Adams said, adding, I'm so tired of us having something, having it be amazing, and then we don't do it again. That's not how we build public trust. However, other events in the series seem to fall flat with council members. Council member Tara Weiner said that, according to a report, hardly any people showed up to one of the dance events, and vendors and contractors there were unhappy with how the event played out. She questioned why 13th Street was chosen as the location for these events, since it's not in a very central part of downtown. You can't activate spaces that people don't go to, she said. The events also took a large amount of city staff time to put on, and they proved costly. In total, it cost the city $173,500 to put on 8 events, more than $21,500 per event on average. Most of that money came from American Rescue Plan Act funding. Other council members were supportive of the overall idea of social streets, but said they'd like to see more of a cost-benefit analysis for future programming and understand how the program fits into the larger picture of changes being made in the downtown Boulder area, including the Civic Area Project, which aims to revitalize the area around Central Park and the municipal building. I'm usually not somebody who says we need to do more planning, but I do think that this is a case where we would benefit from a more integrated plan to look at what we're trying to do within this geographic area, said Councilmember Ryan Skookard. Overall, council members expressed interest in continuing some of the most successful pieces of Boulder Social Streets while spending fewer city resources on the program as a whole. City staff said there were no street activations planned for this year. Aid to come from U.S. Ukraine struggles at the front lines. Country is on defense while facing huge attacks by Russia. By Samia Kulab. Ukrainian commander Oleksiy Tarasenko witnessed a frightening shift last month in Russia's efforts to punch through Kyiv's defenses of the industrial region known as the Donbas. Standing against Russia's unyielding advance in the strategic frontline town of Chasiv Yar, he noticed that, instead of making typically light infantry assaults, Moscow's forces were taking brazen risks by launching battalion and platoon-size attacks, sometimes with up to 10 combat vehicles. His men destroyed up to 80 tanks in the weeks that followed, but it did not slow the enemy. The confidence of the Russian military reflected the Kremlin's knowledge that Ukraine's ammunition supplies were dwindling as the U.S. dawdled over approving more military aid. Saturday's passage by the U.S. House of Representatives of a much-awaited $61 billion package for Ukraine puts the country a step closer to an infusion of new firepower that will be rushed to the front line to fight Moscow's latest attacks. But the clock is ticking. With Russia using all its might to achieve its most significant gains since its invasion by a May 9th deadline, when Moscow commemorates World War II Victory Day. In the meantime, Kyiv has no choice but to wait for replenishment. Seeing a window of opportunity, Russia has seized the momentum on the battlefield and forced Kyiv's forces to cede tactically significant territory, one painful yard after another. Wave after wave of mechanized units came for Tereshenko's brigade. Protected under an umbrella of attack drones and artillery fire, they reached the foot of Chasiv Yar, which is the gateway to Ukraine's defensive backbone in the Donetsk region. They concentrated disproportionately enormous resources in this direction, said Tereshenko, deputy commander of the 5th Separate Assault Brigade. The most difficult thing is to cope with this constant onslaught from the enemy, which does not change even though the enemy is losing a lot of military equipment and soldiers. The Pentagon said it could get weapons moving to Ukraine within days if the Senate and President Joe Biden give final approval to the aid package. But experts and Ukrainian lawmakers said it could take weeks for the assistance to reach troops, giving Russia more time to degrade Ukrainian defenses. The 7-month effort to pass the package effectively held Ukraine hostage to the internal politics of its biggest ally, It also raised concerns about how the shifting sands of American politics will influence future military support. European partners cannot match the volume and scope of American assistance, which remains Kyiv's main hope to win the war. But that support has come with red lines, including rules that forbid using Western-supplied weapons for strikes inside the Russian Federation. Some Ukrainian officials argue that such limits handicap their ability to cripple the enemy's more robust capabilities. Assuming the assistance arrives in the next 2 months, plans are afoot for a potential late summer offensive. Analysts have argued that future support should not count on one big decisive battle, but a sustained strategy over many years. But first, Ukraine must hold off Russia's attempts to break defensive lines and entrenched positions. In the past month, the Associated Press spoke to a dozen commanders across the active zones of the Eastern Front Line, from Kupiansk in the northeast to Bakhmut further south. They said their soldiers have rationed shells and struggled to repel enemy attacks with insufficient artillery ammunition. They are also running critically low on air defense missiles, not only for high-end Patriot systems that protect cities, but also for tactical air systems. That has given Russian fighter bombers an opportunity to lob thousands of deadly aerial glide bombs against Ukrainian positions, raising defenses to the ground, something Russia's Air Force has not been able to do before. Since January, the Kremlin has seized 140 square miles of Ukrainian territory, roughly the size of the American city of Detroit, according to the Washington-based Institute for the Study of War. Ukrainian commanders have complained about dire ammunition shortages since late December. By February, heads of artillery units in several regions said they had less than 10% of the supplies they needed as Kyiv rushed to economize shells. Nowhere are supplies more needed than in Chasiv-Yar, where, after weeks of fierce fighting, Moscow is intent on conquering the town. Ukraine's commander-in-chief, Oleksandr Sirsky, said Russia's top military leadership ordered its soldiers to capture the town by May 9th, Russia's Victory Day, a holiday that marks the defeat of Nazi Germany. To reach that goal, Russia unleashes daily drone assaults and glide bombs on Ukrainian forces that have no way to counterattack. Time is of the essence, said Yuri Fedorenko, commander of the Achilles Battalion of the 92nd Brigade in the Chasiv-Yar region. They simply destroyed our positions with massive strikes. Now those positions are constantly hit by artillery, making it impossible to recapture them, he said. Now we have nothing to answer the enemy with, he added. Commanding men who have reached extreme levels of burnout, Fedorenko acknowledged the Russians were steadily advancing. At the time of the interview, Russian forces were just 1,640 feet from the town, he said. The soldiers who died to protect the land that was lost could have been spared if the U.S. aid had been approved earlier, he said. Our losses could be reduced to a minimum, and we would not have lost territories that would later have to be reconquered. Russia picked up momentum soon after gaining control of Avdiivka in February. Immediately, Moscow's troops sought to reinforce their tactical success and push further into larger, strategically significant towns. Kostyantynivka, Slovinsk, and Druzhkivka, that together form the fortress wall of Ukraine's main defense of the Donetsk region. A win in Chasiv-Yar which had a pre-war population of 12,000, would bring Russia one step closer to breaking that barricade. If the Russians manage to take Chasiv-Yar, they are only about 5 to 7 kilometers away from the southernmost link in that chain, said George Barros, an analyst at the Institute for the Study of War. If Russia manages to push into the seam between Kostyantynivka and Druzhkivka, it would be able to attack the fortress belt, he said. Then we get into the territory where the Russians might be making some really substantial operational gains and eroding Ukraine's ability to defend the rest of Donetsk, he said. An injection of new supplies would give Ukrainian forces cover and help them push the enemy back. But Russia will continue to have the upper hand in both manpower and ammunition. The Russian military has the ability to generate 20,000 to 30,000 new volunteers per month, and it holds a roughly 6-to-1 advantage in artillery. Until now, that reality has precluded any potential for Ukrainian counteroffensive. Russian fighters do not have the feeling that they will now lose some critical armored vehicle unit or soldier unit for which they will no longer have new reinforcements, Tarasenko said. They don't worry about it. That's their advantage. College education. St. Vrain Valley School District and Metropolitan State University, Denver, partner for admission support, by Amy Bounds. St. Vrain Valley and Metropolitan State University of Denver are partnering to create a pathway to higher education for the school district's graduates. MSU Denver will provide St. Vrain students with early access to admission support, financial aid, campus events, and career readiness through the agreement. Dubbed First in the Flock, the initiative is designed to streamline access to higher education and provide students with additional resources and support, district officials said. MSU Denver offers close to 100 majors, as well as 10 graduate programs and 42 certificate programs. The college, located in downtown Denver, enrolls about 16,000 undergraduates and 1,000 graduate students. Long Nguyen, MSU Denver's chief enrollment officer, said the university wanted to partner with St. Vrain because it's a very innovative school district. This is more than just an agreement, he said. We will do anything to make their students' higher education dreams a reality. We want to break down barriers and ensure students are well prepared even before their senior year. We want to help them prepare for a smooth transition to college. He said academic advisors can help St. Vrain students complete the college application, as well as apply for financial aid and choose a college program. St. Vrain students also will be invited to campus events so they can get familiar with the campus. I strongly believe this will help students be more successful, he said. Our hope is that we really connect with students who don't think higher education is an option and show them MSU is the place for them. St. Vrain Valley Chief Academic Officer Diane Lauer said MSU Denver agreed to automatically admit all the district's graduates as part of the partnership. This could be their very first college acceptance letter, she said. When they know they can do this, know that they've been accepted and can go to college, it just opens up opportunity and hope. It builds confidence. She said the partnership is part of the district's goal of providing more access at an earlier age to opportunities that prepare students for what they'll do after graduation, including work-based learning, concurrent enrollment classes, and industry certifications. St. Vrain teachers in programs that correspond to majors offered at MSU Denver, such as aviation and cybersecurity, also can collaborate more closely with the university's faculty to create clear pathways, she said. We're always looking to elevate opportunities for students, she said. We want our students to know about opportunities much sooner than we've done in the past, and Metro State is willing to step up to the plate to do that. Common Spirit Health. Longmont United Hospital expands Cancer Treatment Center. By Ken Admonson. Longmont United Hospital, a division of Common Spirit Health, has opened an expansion of its cancer center at the hospital. The expansion brings medical oncology clinic services and chemotherapy treatment options to the Longmont campus, said DJ Bozziani, Regional Director of Oncology Services, Mountain Region, for Common Spirit. This, coupled with our existing radiation therapy center, gives Longmont United Hospital the full complement of cancer care for our patients, he said. The hospital had a ribbon cutting for the expansion last week. The expansion contains 4 clinic rooms, a consultation room, and 4 private infusion bays for patients receiving chemotherapy. It is targeted to serve a market that includes Longmont, Boulder, Denver, Larimer, Jefferson, and Weld counties. A medical oncology physician will lead the operation with the support of 3 nurses, a medical assistant, insurance specialists, and others involved with support services such as genetic counseling and nutrition services, Bozziani said. Housing. Proposal aimed at keeping rents low. Lawmakers want to give governments right of refusal on complex sales, by Seth Klammen. 9 years ago, one of Silverthorne's few income-restricted housing properties was sold to a private firm. The sale, at a price that was double the property's assessed value, raised worries in the high-cost mountain community that the new owner of the Blue River Apartments might lift rent caps that had kept its 78 units affordable when the requirements lapsed. That expiration has been set for this year, and local officials were sufficiently concerned that they struck a deal with the new Greenwood Village-based owners to extend the affordability protections through at least the end of 2025, in exchange for $650,000. But if the town had known about the sale ahead of time in 2015, said Ryan Hyland, Silverthorne's town manager, then officials could have tried to cobble together the money to buy the apartment complex or arrange its sale to someone else. As Colorado faces a tidal wave of expiring affordability requirements in the coming years, state lawmakers hope to give local authorities the opportunity Silverthorne didn't have. House Bill 1175, which has already passed the House, would grant municipalities a right of first refusal to buy subsidized housing properties when they come up for sale, and would also require more notice of expiring affordability covenants. Once the owner reached a price with a private buyer, the town or city, or a group acting on its behalf, could step in and match the offer, ensuring units wouldn't convert to market-rate rents once affordability requirements expire. When those expire, the new owner could be charging market rents. That's a smart business decision if you're purchasing a property and if you've got that on the horizon, Hyland said. As you can imagine, there's those types of deals that happen, and the local government has no idea they're happening, so there's no opportunity for conversation. In the case of Blue River Apartments, as the initial expiration date approached, The president of Tralee Capital in 2020 told the Summit Daily that he wasn't ready to say how the rental rates would change. The bill passed the House 38-23 earlier this month and is now headed to the state Senate. It's the second attempt by a group of Democratic lawmakers to pass a right of first refusal policy, which they say would give local governments the chance to protect renters from for-profit developers that purchase properties and hike rents. The first swing at passing the policy was a more expansive approach that also would have applied to sales of market-rate buildings. It passed the legislature last year after extensive debate and negotiations. But business groups successfully lobbied Governor Jared Polis to veto it, sparking sharp criticism from the Democratic legislators who backed it. The veto spurred supporters to narrow their approach this year. They focused on preserving the state's existing subsidized housing stock, which is in danger of shrinking in the coming years, said Representative Andy Bosnecker, a Fort Collins Democrat. Colorado is home to roughly 111,000 subsidized units with affordability requirements, according to Colorado Housing and Finance Authority data. It's expensive and complicated to build subsidized housing projects, and developers lean largely on federal tax credits to make the financing work. Those tax credits include requirements that rental rates be capped based on certain income levels. But the requirements are time-limited, often lasting at least 30 years. In the coming decade, 15,000 affordable units here will no longer be subject to the caps that keep them within reach for lower-income Coloradans. That doesn't mean those properties will immediately be sold or switch to market-rate rents or prices. But the looming expirations are a warning sign for housing advocates as they scramble to protect the state's affordable housing stock. When subsidized properties with expiring affordability requirements are purchased by private companies, we see quick and significant increases in rent. We see less of an investment in maintaining the property and caring for residents, said Kinsey Hastet, the Senior Program Director for State and Local Policy at Enterprise Community Partners. So we are trying to disrupt that. Opponents and skeptics, representing business groups and property owners, have argued that the bill would hamper development in the state. Our biggest fear all along with this has been, are we going to create a chilling effect on capital and the markets, and then we won't get the results that we want, which is more housing in the marketplace, said Ted Leidy, the CEO of the Colorado Association of Home Builders, in testimony during an initial committee hearing in February. But supporters say preserving subsidized housing is particularly important now, not only because of the expiring affordability requirements, but also because of Polis's preferred solution to the housing crisis. More housing built more densely across Colorado cities. While some of the advocates backing the right of first refusal bill also support Polis's land use reforms, that policy approach, if successful, will take years to bear fruit. They repeatedly have stressed the need to provide help in the meantime, given the severity of the state's housing affordability crisis. We have to start by preserving the existing affordable housing that we have, Hastet said. Otherwise, we're just going to keep digging the hole deeper, and we're never going to get out of it. Should HB 1175 clear the Senate, the final say would again rest with Polis. Things to do today. The Wide, Wide Sea book signing, 6:30 p.m. Tuesday, Boulder Bookstore, 1107 Pearl Street, Boulder. Hampton Sides will speak about and sign his new book, The Wide, Wide Sea. $5. BoulderBookstore.net. Friendship Goodie Bag Poetry Open Mic. 7 p.m. Tuesday, Boulder Wine Bar. 2027 Broadway, Boulder. Friendship Goodie Bag Poetry Open Mic is hosted by two friends, Amy Herman and Rebecca Diaz. All are welcome to share at the open mic. Bring some poems, come to listen, and make some friends. Free. 347-533-2844. Saint Motel at Boulder Theater, 8 p.m. Tuesday, Boulder Theater, 2032 14th Street, Boulder. Founded by vocalist A.J. Jackson and guitarist Aaron Sharp, film school classmates with a shared appreciation of obscurist cinema, and later rounded out by bassist Dak Lertimerpong and drummer Greg Irwin, Saint Motel first revealed their imaginative take on alt-pop with their 2009 debut EP, Foreplay. The band soon amassed a devoted underground following, thanks in part to a series of experiential concerts, with such themes as Zombie Prom and Judgment Day, then found breakout success with their critically acclaimed 2012 debut album, Voyeur. In addition to touring with acts like Arctic Monkeys, Imagine Dragons, Band of Skulls, and Weezer, Saint Motel have also spent much of the last half decade bringing their captivating live show to leading festivals like Coachella, Lollapalooza, and Bonnaroo. $29.50 to $32.50. Z2ENT.com. Mug Magic for Teens. 6 p.m. Tuesday. Library. 409 4th Avenue, Longmont. Make a customized mug using sublimation technology. Create a professional-looking mug to keep or give as a gift for a friend or loved one. Choose from one of many designs and create a special, one-of-a-kind treasure. LongmontColorado.gov. Tomorrow. Passing Hats. 1:30 p.m. Wednesday. Carbon Valley Regional Library, 7 Park Avenue, Firestone. Passing Hats has been making hats and giving them to cancer patients since March of 2011. The group knits, crochets, looms, and sews hats, and everything is provided. Beginners are welcome. Club members can help teach newcomers how to start off looming a hat. Free. 888-861-7323. HighPlains.libcal.com. Procrastinating Teen Fiber Club, 6 p.m. Wednesday, Library, 409 4th Avenue, Longmont. Join Procrastinating Teen Fiber Club to create and hang out with other teens. No instruction or specific project provided. A small selection of tools and yarn will be available, or participants can bring their own projects to work on. LongmontColorado.gov. Family Book Club, 6 p.m. Wednesday, Carbon Valley Regional Library, 7 Park Avenue, Firestone. This is a book club geared toward school-age children, ages 7 to 11, and their grown-ups. Each month, participants will read a different fictional chapter book. Families will get to take their copies home and read together over the next month. At the next meeting, attendees will talk about the book and enjoy activities and crafts related to the book. Snacks will be provided, and a new book will be introduced each month. Free. HighPlains.libcal.com. The Korean Herbal Apothecary Book Signing, 6:30 p.m. Wednesday, Boulder Bookstore, 1107 Pearl Street, Boulder. Grace Yoon will speak about and sign her new book, The Korean Herbal Apothecary, $5, BoulderBookstore.net. Trivia Night at Liquid Mechanics Brewing, 6:30 p.m. Wednesday, Liquid Mechanics Brewing, 297 North U.S. Highway 287, Suite 100, Lafayette. Bring friends and family for trivia night and food trucks. There will be first, second, and third place prizes, as well as 5 free pints given out throughout the game. Free. 720-550-7813. Many Mountains at the Velvet Elk Lounge. 8 p.m. Wednesday. The Velvet Elk Lounge. 2037 13th Street, Boulder. Americana Duo. Many Mountains is a folk rock duo from Colorado. Forming in 2013, K.R. Nelson and Dustin Moran bring a genre-bending sound to folk rock through their unique song arrangements and writing styles. From Gillian Welch to the Rolling Stones, the range of musical influences trickle through their music to create something fresh yet familiar. A kaleidoscope of sound, songs are interlaced with vocal harmonies and leads that alternate between the two songwriters. Free. 303-993-8743. Colorado. Flurry of Gun Bills Advance in Legislature by Seth Klaman. Fresh off a historic vote to advance a ban on many high-powered, semi-automatic guns, the Colorado House approved 3 more gun-related bills over the weekend, sending them across the Capitol for another round of debate. Those votes on Saturday were followed Monday by the state Senate's final approval for 2 other gun reform bills dealing with concealed carry permits and firearm storage in vehicles. The House's Saturday votes on bills concerning gun dealer licensing, insurance requirements for gun owners, and taxes on sales of guns and ammunition relied on support only from Democrats, though varying numbers of the majority caucus opposed each bill, joining Republicans. The party splits were similar for Monday's votes in the Senate. The legislature's Democrats this year have embraced gun control and reform measures as they seek to reduce gun violence, advancing a slate of bills that would add new restrictions while also seeking to better enforce existing laws. Their Republican colleagues have blasted the legislative package as potentially violating the Second Amendment, and their allies have promised swift legal challenges should many of the bills ever become law. Democratic House leadership on Friday limited initial debate on each measure to between 90 minutes and 2 hours, an increasingly common tactic used to head off Republican filibustering for contentious debates. While the highest-profile measure, the ban on assault weapons, awaits a Senate committee hearing, here is where the other newly advanced bills stand. Concealed carry training, passed 20-14 by the Senate, House Bill 1174, would increase requirements for anyone seeking to obtain a concealed carry permit. The bill would require in-person training and live fire exercises, 8 hours of coursework, and a test that a trainee must pass. The bill's next stop is Governor Jared Polis's desk. Gun storage in vehicles, passed 21-13 by the Senate. House Bill 1348 would require that when gun owners leave firearms in their vehicles, they store them in a locked, hard-sided container. Changes made by moderate Democrats and Republicans in the Senate to increase some criminal penalties for thefts of firearms set up disagreements with the House-passed version. Representative Elizabeth Velasco said sponsors were likely to send the bill to a negotiating committee to strip out the penalties. Liability insurance, passed by the House, 33-29, with the barest majority possible. House Bill 1270 would require gun owners to also hold liability insurance that covers injury, death, or property damage caused by any accidental or unintentional discharge of the firearm. Supporters say most people with homeowners or renters insurance likely already have coverage. The bill now goes to the Senate. Tax on guns and ammo, passed by the House 44-18. House Bill 1349 proposes to ask voters in November whether the state should apply a 9% excise tax on ammo vendors, gun dealers, and firearm manufacturers. The first $35 million raised from the tax would go to crime victim service grants, with the next $20 million split between schools and mental health services. The bill now goes to the Senate. Gun dealer licensure, passed by the House 40-21. Under House Bill 1353, retail gun dealers who already need federal licenses would need a state permit too. Supporters argue that federal authorities lack the resources to adequately investigate potential violations of state or federal law. The bill would also require shop owners and employees to undergo training to better secure the weapons and to spot potentially illegal sales. The bill now moves to the Senate. During debate of the licensure bill, House Republicans, who uniformly opposed it, accused Democrats of focusing on law-abiding gun dealers. Marshall Fire. Louisville Council hears updates on recovery, by Andrea Grajada. The Louisville City Council heard updates about Marshall Fire recovery, going over recovery efforts and mitigation efforts the city and community are taking. According to the Louisville website, as of April 22nd, of the 550 homes and businesses lost in the fire, 203 units are under construction, 202 have received certificates of occupancy, and 19 rebuild permits are being reviewed. At the April 16th council meeting, Recovery and Resilience Manager Kiana Freeman said her division has been working on the disaster management program with the goal of leading Marshall Fire recovery while implementing resilience, helping the community build back stronger. The Marshall Fire swept through Boulder County, Superior, and Louisville on December 30, 2021. Part of the recovery efforts that the Recovery and Resilience Division is doing is supporting not just in the physical rebuild, but all of the efforts going on, Freeman said. Freeman said the city will partner with Superior for the Disaster Preparedness Education Series, which the city also hosted last summer. The series focused on a different topic each month to educate the community on preparedness and increase resilience. On May 23rd, Boulder County will host a webinar to go over updates regarding the Community Wildfire Protection Plan, which identifies and prioritizes ways to reduce wildfire risks. The plan was last updated in 2011, and according to the Boulder County website, the new plan will be completed this year. More information is available at louisville.gov/living-in-louisville/residents/resilient-louisville. The Recovery and Resilience Division also works to connect residents with mental health partners and Jewish Family Services for any support needed. Freeman said the city will continue to evaluate any other mental health resources the community may need. The city has received 385 city use tax credit requests available to property owners whose property was destroyed or sustained significant damage after the Marshall Fire. The city has issued $5,539,120 in credits. The average cost of construction for residents rebuilding is $900,771. In December 2023, the council passed an ordinance to allow residents whose homes were damaged by sustained smoke, heat, water, ash, or other damage due to the fire to exempt construction materials from the city's use tax and allow those residents to opt out of the 2021 building codes when rebuilding. Before, only homes that were significantly damaged or destroyed in the fire were exempt. Director of Finance, Ryder Bailey, said fire-related expenses have cost the city $29.8 million, but the city is anticipating to recover approximately 75% of those costs, the majority of which will come from the Federal Emergency Management Agency. The remaining costs, not externally covered, approximately $8.1 million, comes from uncoverable losses like business income loss or disaster-related expenses not covered by FEMA. Freeman said the Public Works Department is continuing to monitor streets and sidewalks as construction progresses. The Parks and Open Space Department have completed repairing all amenities damaged in the fire and are continuing to work on replacing the landscape on damaged areas. The Louisville Fire Protection District is also working with local fire departments in districts and the county to implement new response protocols for wildfires. The city is also taking precautions to minimize possible fuel for fire by managing open space areas with mowing, cattle grazing, and removal of woody fuels. CU Boulder. Students win $100,000 to reduce food waste, by Olivia Doak. A team of students at the University of Colorado Boulder won $100,000 for a business idea that could eliminate food waste and boost profits for restaurants. The team created a concept called Foodwise, a software platform that helps restaurants predict food demand through factors including weather, historical sales, holidays, local events, and restaurant promotions. By more accurately predicting food demand, the software can help boost profits and reduce food waste. Foodwise is a machine learning software that predicts real-time consumer demand, team member and CU Boulder senior Emma Bonnerb said. The competition, called the New Venture Challenge, was held at the Boulder Theater on Wednesday. CU Boulder teams of students and faculty brought their best pitches to a panel of judges as they competed to get their businesses off the ground through venture funding. The challenge also connects the teams with mentors from the Boulder community. Foodwise received $100,000 for first place. Second place was awarded $30,000, and third place earned $10,000. Fourth and fifth place were awarded $5,000 each. It feels amazing to be rewarded for something we worked so hard on, team member and senior Byron Patton said. The award money is granted so the winning teams can turn their business ideas into reality. The Foodwise team plans to use the funds to create a prototype of the software and begin to test it with restaurant customers. CU Boulder senior and Foodwise team member Hashir Lukman said there's only one person working on the prototype for the software. Jennifer Bundrant, who graduated from CU Boulder in December, said the team is looking to hire new software developers and is seeking out student interns through CU Boulder classes. That will help us accelerate the development process a lot further, Lukman said. The idea for Foodwise came after the team had spent time working in restaurants. Bonner recalled once taking out the garbage at a restaurant she worked at, and the manager said they could have fed the whole city with the food they had to throw away. That sparked, "This is a big problem, and I wondered if we could come up with a solution for this," she said. Stan Hickory, new venture challenge director, said it's exciting to see a team that came together from an idea. They have an innovative solution to a sustainability issue that every restaurant in the nation faces, he said, adding, "As far as I know, no one is taking that issue. No one is tackling that issue to the depth of how they want to tackle it." Bonner said she hopes to help restaurants save money in a hard industry with changing economic variables since the COVID-19 pandemic. "We hope we can help them succeed, and we want to help reduce the amount of waste they produce and help the environment," she said. Thank you for joining us for the Boulder Daily News, read by Kathy Piancone.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.